Welcome to On the Edge with April Mahoney Brains. Here, this is the spot where the conversation is pointed, the guests are sharp, and the responses are never dull. Welcome home, brains. There's only one requirement to hang out on the edge, is that you open your big brain and close your small mind. Did you bring your thinking caps? It's time to put them on, because the conversation starts now.
Hello, brains, and welcome to On the Edge with April Mahoney. This is the spot right here where I can't even say my guest's name.
Lots of other people have that problem.
The place where the conversation is pointed, the guests are sharp, and the responses are never dull, and we've got Julie Jacklepick. See?
You got it.
I can do it. She is the business. She is the founder of, let me get that right. It seems like I've been drinking this morning. I don't know, but she is the founder of I Lead Strategies. They're on the East Coast, and she's got an amazing job. She works with people at organizational development for leaders and politrickians. I call them politrickians. She works with campaign people and really tries to help them work out these strategies. I want to talk to her about that. I know we can't just focus the conversation on that, but that is a hard job because you got to edit and filter. You got to manage their perception. You got to manage the audience, the messaging. She's the business. And so we want to welcome her here to The Edge. Julie, how you doing with your pretty self?
I'm good. I'm delighted to be with you. And, you know, like people who want to change the world work hard. You work hard, I work hard, and at the end of the day, I realize we like to call them politrickians, and some of them are complete and total jerks, and you have to have an ego to put yourself out there, but most of them want to make the world better.
No, and I,
you know, may not agree.
And I say politrickians because, you know, and it's not them personally, you know, I'm sure that they go into it with good intentions, but once you get into the mix, you've got to do what it takes to survive, number one. To get your voice heard, number two, to make a decision, because I'm mad at every single one of them. Every single one of them. There has not been a piece of legislation that has been completed in the last 8 years of any substantial, you know, value. And the one
I think there's a lot of things you and I both want that have gotten stuck, but I actually think the CARES Act was really important.
Okay.
So there's a few things have gotten done. And the truth is, the reason things don't get done is we are very evenly divided as a country. And so the House and Senate are very evenly divided. And you and I suspect we're probably more aligned than not. We could make a list of all the things we want the politicians we elect to do for us and to protect us from. And it would be exactly the opposite of what the other side would list. And so you have a real tug of war, and it's really hard in this particular environment for a whole bunch of reasons to find common ground. There is a book I read years ago called The Big Sort. And I grew up in Washington, DC area. So The Big Sort is really about how we sort ourselves about where we live and who lives near each other. And really, unlike when you and I were kids, people tend to live around people who have the same political values. But there are a couple things that were really interesting in that book as somebody who grew up here. And it really explains a lot. When we were kids, housing compared to travel was really expensive compared to housing. So senators' families were in DC. Members of the House lived in DC. Their children all went to school together. Their wives sat across from each other. Their kids became friends regardless of the parties of their parents. And so they had to be civil, right? Like they had to actually talk to one another, because when you went to the school ball game, Democrat kids and Republican kids were on the same team.
Right.
Now housing's expensive and travel's cheap.
Well,
so now four members of Congress share a two-bedroom apartment. They never have to be around anybody who doesn't agree with them. Their wives and kids are at home. And so the easy, low-key, unstressful places they had to come together don't exist.
Right. Okay.
But so they didn't.
But beyond the personalities and the politicians, messaging messaging is huge.
Yep.
Perception is huge. Persona is huge. You know, ego, we all have an ego. We need to learn to manage it. How in the world did you get involved in this type of work to begin with? And then I want you to dial back a little bit and tell me more about iLead strategies.
So in some ways, I came to this work genetically. I grew up in a family that did retail, you know, pro-business Democrats. My mom worked on the McGovern campaign, did advance work for Senator McGovern when he was running for, actually for Sergeant Shriver when he was running for vice president. And, you know, all the way down to an office in the Watergate and a bugged house and all of that kind of craziness. So I think my, you know, and I got to go volunteer, as I'm sure it was another word for childcare. But I got to go with mom, right? And so I remember, this is definitely a strange story, but it's a fun one, which is like, you know, this was in the 70s. So you got hard checks, no bank transfers. And when people had donation checks, you had to go to the copier and make a copy of them. And then you had to deliver the checks to one place and the copies somewhere else. And that was the kind of clerical stuff that a kid could do. And so, you know, I was about 12, 13 years old and hanging out with high school kids doing the same thing. And then I would take the checks to somebody's office and I would take the copies upstairs to this guy who had this big office, but he talked to me like I was a human, not like I was a kid. He wanted to know what I cared about and why I was there. And he wore this big cowboy hat and he had his cowboy boots on the desk. And I would have these deep, soulful conversations with Gary Hart. Who left the Senate in scandal, but you know, he treated me like a grown-up and he asked really good questions and asked questions about politics. And so between that and then the fact that my mother worked for a guy whose name was Max Factor III, and he was in fact that Max Factor. Wow. He went on to be an attorney in LA and do really good work in Southern California. But you know, that was, Max was her boss, and you know, he actually got me permission to split my Oreo cookies, because in our house you had to bite into an Oreo cookie, but on his desk was always this big thing of Oreo cookies, and I got to like split my Oreo cookie without getting yelled at. And so, you know, I was exposed to big ideas and powerful people really early. Mm-hmm. And so A, I'm comfortable with them. B, even more than my own parents, they were, I mean, you know, Max Factor left his law practice to come to DC for a summer and run a presidential campaign.
Right.
I mean, the people I was getting to meet had made big sacrifices to do the work they were doing. And so, you know, some of it came with the territory. Now I'm not, iLead Strategies is an organizational development company where I try to help leaders build resilient organizations and their own resilience so they get to have a life they love, and they're typically people doing big things. They are not all political, but the political part of it, well, or they're not all capital P political.
Okay.
Right. You know, small P political counts too. And small P is about collective power. You know, it's about how do we bring people, how do we inspire, you know, as leaders, how do we inspire people? How do we share our big vision? How do we get other people willing to do the hard work of bringing that vision to reality, even if it doesn't happen on the first, second, or 27th try? Like, how do we do that? And how do we do that when the things worth, I mean, I live in a town that takes itself, the big difference between LA and DC is everybody works hard, but in LA, they play hard too. In DC, everybody works hard and works hard. Because whether we agree with what they're working on, and there are certainly people I disagree with regularly, they believe they are doing good. They mean to be doing good in general. Does that mean that they are never racist? No. Does that mean that I agree with their decisions? No, not all the time. But they don't come here. You don't make a ton of money in the Senate. You arrive in the Senate with money. I mean, our senators are millionaires. You can come to the House without a lot of money, but you're not. It's not like you're going to make a fortune being a member of Congress. These are service jobs. Whether we like it or not, they're jobs of service.
Right. Well, I just want to say, Brains, you hear that? So when they don't make a cotton picking decision, we can just go ahead and not pay them because they already got money. That's just me talking.
That's, on the Senate side, that's absolutely true. On the Senate side, on the House side, lots of them don't have money. You know, they have enough to get here, but I mean, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's story is not unique to her of trying to figure out how to buy clothes and living in her office for a little bit and all of that. I mean, we have what I was saying earlier is we've got a bunch of members of the House where four men share a two-bedroom apartment and never talk to anybody that doesn't agree with them, except on the floor of the House. Not healthy.
So tell me a little bit about a campaign. You know,
I like a crisis.
Yeah, well, I love a campaign because, you know, I ran for office. My husband wanted me to run for our community council, and I told him no because I'm liable to pop off and tell you how I really feel, you know. But I would get something done. I say that. But you're not alone in all of this. And it's heavily involved. Like I said, there's got to be a strategy, much like life is running a campaign. You've got to have messaging. You've got to stay on point. You've got to be a good listener because you have to listen to what your constituents want and tailor your message, your platform, and your campaign around what they want and then stay with those talking points. So another thing I'm going to ask you about, those talking points, I've learned that. When you get a talking point, you get three or four, you don't deviate from those. You stick on that. So tell me a little bit about running a campaign and what that takes. I know it's exciting.
So I think about campaigns in a lot of ways. I think they are sort of created crises and they're an incredible laboratory to hone your crisis management skills. They are long days, more work than you could ever possibly do. So they require great triage. They require focus. They require delegation. And the good news is they're time limited, right? There is an end point.
Okay.
Right. And so it's like it is a created crisis and people need to know what their message is and stay on it. They need to not do what is not what can. So for a candidate, it is a lesson in letting go because you do not get to do your job as a candidate is to do the things only a candidate can do. And that is mostly ask for votes and ask for money. And money is about votes. Money is there are not enough hours in the day to have seven individual conversations with everyone who can vote for you. So money is a substitute for getting your face and your message in front of people seven times to get them out to vote for you. And so that's the job of the candidate. And everything else is somebody else's job. I also ran for office. I run a bunch of campaigns. The only one I didn't win was my own. And there's lots of reasons for that, some of which live with me, some of which maybe don't. But at the end of the day, it was my job and I didn't win. But, you know, there's something about coming home to your house and seeing 17 people sitting in stairwells and closet doorways making calls on your behalf.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I've worked.
It's pretty amazing, right? You know, there's something about people saying, no, I'll walk with you in the pouring rain.
Right. And that's what I like about politicians is that they're like Pied Pipers. People follow you. They believe in you. They support you. They encourage you. They will go and toe the line for you, you know, until something comes up that's maybe disingenuous or kind of seedy. How do you get in front of that messaging? You know, because it happens to the best of us. Everybody's had some scandal. Something happens and it always seems to happen. It's very calculated. It always seems to come up at the right time. Sexual indiscretions, IRS, you know, all of this kind of stuff. How do you get in front of the messaging in the middle of a campaign and keep your candidate focused and also keep the integrity of their messaging? Because again, we're all human beings. We've all done something.
You know, stuff happens. And most of it, what drives me the most crazy, April, is it's almost all predictable.
Oh, yeah.
It's all predictable. So the way you really do it is you come clean with your team at the very beginning about anything stupid that's going to come up. Mm. The bankruptcy, the ex-wife, the kid you didn't know about, the the student loan you lied about, whatever it was, so that you have a plan for dealing with it and you don't write messaging that is inconsistent with your actual life. Mm. You don't, right? You don't run on things that you are, if you've got, you know, so in my own case, I have a brother who's had some serious problems with the law and with addiction. I said, you know, we talked about my big dramatic family. My father died when I was 14 by suicide. There's lots of crazy and that could come up. So from my perspective, when Bill Clinton was impeached, his attorney is somebody we now know as Michael Cohen's attorney, but his attorney was a guy named Lanny Davis. Mm-hmm. Lanny Davis wrote a book called Truth to Tell. The cover of the book is a legal pad, and it says, tell the truth, tell it all, tell it yourself, tell it first. Period. That is it. If it's bad, it's coming out of my mouth first, truthfully, before anybody else, without leaving out the weird little detail that's really the thing. Because once I've done that, you can't do anything to me.
Right.
So if you think about Jeff Bezos, blasting the world with his affair.
Right.
Can't get him with it anymore.
Right. And then my mother used to always tell me that. She said, you never give other people ammunition to fight you with. You just don't.
You control the message and you control the story. And the reason you and I find out about things in big, salacious ways isn't that the story was big and salacious and surprising. It's that they didn't think anybody would find out. I'm sorry, if you've not heard this yet, it is 2021. If it can be found out, it will be found out. If you've said something stupid online, there are easy, free tools to see what a website looked like on any date in the past. If it has been there, it can be found. So listeners, even though you took it down, if I really want to find it, it's not hard.
Exactly.
And I'm not a detective. Right. It is not hard.
Let's talk about money for a minute. I'm sorry. But I want to talk about, okay, so these politicians or people that run in campaigns, they get millions, billions of dollars. How is that money funneled and channeled? I mean, I know it's for, you know, television ads and lawn signs and your staff and, you know, but a lot of stuff is pro bono too. What's your ability on that?
So I don't have pricing in front of me to tell you what a minute on television costs, but a minute on television is expensive. So their campaign, let's be careful. Their campaigns get money. It's not a personal check to Julie or April. And the money mostly goes to some form of advertising. So some of it, smaller portion, some of it will go to polling. Some of it'll go to right to travel and security and staff, but it's all about getting votes. So it's paying people to organize people, train them in your messaging and knock doors. It's a little bit phone but less and less phone over time. It's harder to find people. People don't answer their phones. So it might be text.
Yeah.
But most of it is going to television. It's still, I mean, there's lots of it will go to Facebook ads. Facebook ads are great for awareness, not great for motivation. So Jack-a-Pick is a pain in the butt name, right? It was hard for you to say, it's weird to spell. Facebook ads are great for that because out of the corner of your eye, you're going to see my name 187 times and you'll recognize it when you hear it. Mm-hmm. That does not get you, that's not in my face enough to get me to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning and go stand in line. But Facebook ads are great for name recognition, and social media, not just Facebook. Social media is great for name recognition, not yet proven to have big impact in motivation. Motivation is you and I talking to each other.
Mm-hmm.
We used to, when you and I were growing up, there were four TV stations. You put your ad on all four of them at the times that your voters were watching.
Right.
Well, now you've got 400 TV stations, 17 streaming services, all of which can be targeted in particular ways, 17 social media outlets, and radio, and broadcast,
and print.
And print, right? So you have all of these ways, and so everybody, the money is mostly going to get messaging out in front of people. The broadcast audience literally was broadcasting to all of us at once. Right. Most of what we have now is narrowcast. So you have to figure out how to slice it. The good news is that we can target almost to the household voters. The bad news is we have to do it. We have to figure out who the right people are and get the messages to the right people. You know, there are 300 million Americans, 330 million Americans, times seven touches to get them to get up and vote for you. That's right. A ton of money. And the other thing, and ironically, it is still ridiculously powerful, is postal mail.
I love print mail. Yeah, because mail. I look at it, you know, and you get that personal mm-hmm. pitch. I want to talk to you about something else. Voter suppression. You know, here I am, a brown child, okay? Mm-hmm. And they are really trying to turn back the hands of time.
Yep.
And, you know, people don't realize, I've turned so many young people's mind around what voting actually is, you know, because we were 2/3 of a human being to even get our vote. Women didn't get the right to vote. Voting is the cheapest, easiest thing that you can do to have a voice. You see how some folks would do anything, even an insurrection, to try to regain and sustain power. Our democracy is at risk. I never thought in America that we would be so divided. Now, who do they want us to lead? A dictator? Do they think that that person is really going to have our best interests at heart? Do they really want to get rid of capitalism? And, you know, do they want a social, socialism? I just, all these isms. And it's really, really sad. Really sad. What's your view, or just a helicopter view?
Okay, I feel like there's like 14 questions in there. I'm going to pick two.
Yeah, I don't want you to put yourself in an adversarial position.
Oh, no.
Really, you know, just really, what
I'm gonna pick two. Going on? I'm going to pick two. One is the sociologist in me, and the other is about voter suppression. So as terrible as what we live through, well, as I obviously you and I believe that the most recently departed president was a problem. And I'm going to assume that if we're going to offend voters by that, listeners by that, we already have done it. So if Trump was scary to you, what's scarier is this is not a U.S. problem. It's a global problem. It's not different than Bolsonaro in South America. It's not different than Erdogan in Turkey. It is very much the last gasp of, I'm sorry, white men. I think for people, one of my favorite books is a book by Tom Friedman called Sorry for Being Late. For the first time in most of human history, the world is changing faster than people can adapt. So if you were the quintessential archetypal 1950s white man, and I realize nobody actually is just that, but it's for this time that we have together, the world is not the world you grew up in. Who people marry is different. Your employer does not take care of you for 30 years. All kinds of things are different. And that's scary. And that's happening all over the world. That's not just happening in the United States. And so that is a, you know, and so when people do things out of fear, they like clear structure, black and white rules. All of those things are the things we cling to in times of crisis and when we're scared. And so what they, to my mind, from that like 3,000 foot view, what they voted for was clarity and the way things used to be. And whatever it was going to take to get that and keep that. And that's, dictators are very efficient.
They are. And I know I hate to say that publicly, Brains, but yes, I do. I dig a dictator. I've got a little bit of that in me. I don't like how they treat their people, you know, as, you know.
Well, right.
Jung-un and,
they're very efficient though, right? So if you're trying to stop a train of modernity, that's appealing. So I think that's that. From the voter suppression perspective, if you can't win an election, with all the voters, then let's keep the voters out who aren't going to vote for us, which is what we're seeing happen. And then there are the swing voters, but I think what we're seeing is terrible. I think we thought it couldn't happen here. I think when we should have passed the voting rights legislation federally, we didn't, because we got lots of things that have expired we keep doing. And it just never occurred to anybody. And I think
occurred to them. I think that was a strategic move too. You know, that and that's
I think it hurt them. And I think the pandemic changed voting. It's funny, I have a client who's doing a book actually about, she's a photographer who's doing a book about the 2020 election and how the pandemic changed the election. And not just about outcome, which it may or may not have, but the way people voted for the first time was different. We had more ways to vote, more hours to vote, depending on where you were, right? We figured out that, gosh, the military has been mailing in their ballots forever. Mm-hmm. Maybe we could let citizens on the continent do it too. So I think voter suppression is very real. And I think Georgia is a case in point. Texas is another one. But the little things happening the change that sticks is usually incremental. It doesn't take a lot, right? And the margins of victory were not huge. So if you're Georgia, where the margins of victory were just a couple percent, you can get, if you can get 2% of people not to be able to vote, you might win. Hmm. So I'm hoping it will work its way through the courts. And I think I'm very afraid of a number of things happening in the court, but yeah. One of the things about the courts is they are small C conservatives, right? We've seen some surprises. Let me be very clear. I am not happy with the current membership of our Supreme Court for a variety of reasons, but I actually think the court system in general tends to be conserving, not politically conservative, but conserving. And so I'd be curious to see what happens with some of this voter stuff.
Well, we have a front row seat. So now let's talk a little bit about iLead strategies.
Yes, ma'am.
Tell me all the good stuff that's going on over there and how you're helping people and coaching people and developing them, outside of this other stuff.
Well, I think I come at it from sort of two ways. Like some of it is coaching clients who I do organizational with, and some of it's organizational clients who I coach. But they say it's lonely at the top, because it actually is. And that's true of the politicians too. Everybody wants something from them. Mm-hmm. And so being a thinking partner in a safe place to say something stupid or try out an idea and figure out how to make it a good one is a really important thing for leaders. I also think, and I think we saw it with Simone Biles this week.
Bravo. I say absolutely bravo. And let me interject right there. Young brains, I am so impressed with you, because you are going to change the world. You are at the point in your life where you say, I don't give a damn. I'm tired. I'm stressed out. I'm going to sit this one out. It's always been, you're a leader, you're a champion, the show must go on, you're an actor. But now these young people are saying, you know what? I'm going to look at me. I'm going to take care of me for a minute. I'm not going to go into this competition, hurt my team, hurt myself. I'm not going to play tennis and, have a meltdown there on the court for everybody to talk about for the next 10 years on social media. So bravo. I'm sorry. I had to interject that, because I'm happy with them.
Cool. I can hear it, and I'm happy with and I won't say I'm not happy with it, but I want to hone in on a couple things, because actually what Simone Biles did is why we won the medals we won.
Okay.
As a leader, she knew that to compete was to risk those things.
Right.
Had she done a vault like the one she did a somersault out of, she'd have cost the score. Stepping out is how we actually did well. her support of the team saying, I am not the best person today for us, was huge. So it isn't just a personal decision that she made. She made the organ. So Naomi Osaka is a different story for me. And it's not that I don't support her, but there's something very specific that we saw Simone Biles do as a leader. And we talked a little bit about ego. It was more important to her, not just to take care of herself, but that the team do well, than she try to get yet one more medal.
Right.
And so in stepping out, she enabled the success of her team. She enabled a brand new gold medal winner. So now we have two, right? By getting out of the way of her team, she took care of herself and the team. And that's the message that I wanted to capture in this part of the conversation, because that's what I think supporting a leader is, and helping leaders see that big picture and not be, you know, when we're exhausted, I think most of us get brittle and we make brittle decisions. We get crunchy, right? We don't look at the whole chessboard. We don't see the whole thing. She did. And that is a leadership skill that's very hard to develop at 24 and hard to develop generally. And that's the kind of thinking, I mean, I had nothing to do with it, but that's the kind of thinking that I try to work with people to have, mm-hmm. is how do you empower your team? If you've got to control everything, then no, the team can't do more than you can touch.
Right.
How do you decide it's going to be okay if somebody on your team, now I'm thinking about her coach, but how do you decide that if somebody on the team fails, how are you going to handle it? Because that's actually the job. The job isn't to make sure nobody ever makes a mistake. Last I checked, we were all human. It's to know what you're going to do if something does go wrong and be able to stand in the storm and address it. So think about the coaching staff this week who, with very short notice, had one gymnast who wasn't supposed to compete. She was the alternate, right? Jade. And got her ready in a matter of hours to do something she'd never done. Now, I think there's a ton of things we have not done well for this Olympic team, period. If these folks are used to having an audience, we didn't let them go perform in an empty arena and learn how to be without an audience.
Right.
I heard a young woman talk about she couldn't trust herself. She wasn't sure she could trust herself without her family there. Now, I'm somebody who barely understands what that means. My family was almost never there, and I think I would have been more pressured had they been there. But for her, this was a completely new experience, not just because she was at the Olympics, not just because of COVID. And I think we spend a lot of time training them physically. We don't spend enough time training them mentally. I also loved that, as far as Simone was concerned, we called it a medical decision, not a personality decision.
Right.
This wasn't, I don't want to do it.
Right.
This is a medical space in which I don't believe I can do it. And that I think was a really important piece.
The messaging.
And I think it was messaging, and some of the messaging at the beginning was pretty rocky, but it was also an incredibly leaderly set of decisions. And so, you know, when I think about the work I do with iLead, you know, part of what we're trying to do is many of the folks I work with are leading fairly large nonprofit organizations, and the work they do does hit the newspapers and is about supporting people, and things happen. So being prepared and knowing what you're going to do and having those messages written and played with, I actually think the way we do messaging well is we play with lots of things. We don't find the first right answer and go with it. We find a few right answers and play with them. You can do that when things are calm. You can't do that when you're going to walk out the door and there's a mic in your face. So having that space to think through in advance, who are the messengers? Who's in charge? What are we going to say? What messages fly? What messages are a lawyer going to let us say? Because, you know, the easiest answer for a lawyer is no. You don't get in trouble for what you don't do. So from a legal perspective, it's pretty easy to say nothing to no one, except that's a really good way to destroy your brand. So how do you negotiate that space? You got to do it. Ideally, you do it beforehand. I mean, I'm happy to come help you fix it after it's broken, but have certainly done so, but I'd much rather see people play with things in advance.
But to stand up and have courage and be honest and have integrity is a lost art. And, you know, you tell your kids all the time, don't lie to me. You know, you don't have to lie. My mother taught me that. She said, baby, I don't care what you do. You kill somebody, you know, you rob a bank. You can always trust me. And there's an element of trust. But trust can hold you captive, too, because trust is contingent upon something else. Oh, okay, well, you know, I trust you if you do dot, 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 dot. And if you don't do dot, 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 then you don't have my trust. And, you know, you have to prove your loyalty. A lot of people want loyalty. You know, you sell your soul to the devil sometimes for loyalty. So with I Lead, you've really got your work cut out to change the mindset of the individuals to come clean.
And I think authenticity wins. And most of the stuff, most of these crises that you've mentioned, ransomware attacks, stupid on a computer, even stealing, short of actually killing people, nobody dies.
No,
they don't. They have lots to heal from, but they go on to live lives. I mean, I look at what Jimmy Carter did with his, has done with his life, because he wasn't president a second term.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The world is much better off.
Right.
You know, I mean, I think there's a lot of ways that, and people recover. I mean, I think, you know, even Richard Nixon, who clearly my family didn't want to see elected, you know, went on to do good in the world. That doesn't mean he wasn't paranoid. That doesn't mean he didn't lie, but he did some international things that, you know, we wouldn't be talking to China if it wasn't for him. So
again, and Americans love the comeback kid. They always love a good redemption story, and we are forgiving. We are forgiving. But
if it's real.
If it's real, and if you are this word is overused, authentic, whatever the hell that's supposed to mean, you know, and you can't be disingenuous, and you can't do it again. But I can't stand a lie. Right. And you know what? I don't like people that lied right in my face. A no will suffice. I can't do this. I don't want to talk about it. All of that is fine with me. When you lie to me and tell me that that wall behind you is orange and I'm clearly looking at it and it's blue, I got a problem with you. Okay.
Funny, I used to have to train my husband on this one because I'm pretty intuitive. And so if I asked what's wrong, I knew what was wrong. I rarely didn't actually know. And so I had to teach him that he could say, I don't want to talk about it, but he couldn't say nothing. Because the instinct is nothing, I'm fine. And I was like, that's lying. I actually know something's wrong. So I need you to acknowledge it. Tell me you don't want to talk about it.
Right.
Tell me you'll talk to me on Thursday about it. Tell me you don't know yet, whatever, but nothing is a lie.
Nothing is
and yet we're taught to say that, right? We all do it. I do it too. How are you? Fine. Not really, but you didn't mean to ask.
I'm gonna give it to you straight with no chaser. So I'm a little bit different with that. You know, it doesn't work for me. No, I'm sorry. I don't want to talk about it. Or I made a mistake. See, my mother was a very interesting character. She never apologized. Never apologized. The words, I'm sorry, fell on deaf ears. She said they were empty and they were shallow. Because a person knows their intention from the get-go. They know what they're doing. When they do it, sometimes people make mistakes. Don't get me wrong. Now, if there was a mistake, she says she acknowledges the mistake and won't let it happen again. But if you, you know, shoot someone's child, or you put...
Oh, absolutely. Unintended consequences.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But it's about accepting responsibility for your actions and moving on. Well, you have been a wealth of information. I could talk to you forever and ever and ever. Please tell my brains how to get in contact with you, Julie, because I want them to really do some soul searching about how they feel politically. And I'm not talking about one side versus the other, but just the grand scheme of things, what you went over. You know, where these dollars are going when you make these campaign investments, when you're listening to the messaging of a particular candidate, when you are looking at legislation, when you are listening to lobbyists, when you are building an organization, because you got a president, you got a vice president, you got chair, you got a board, all of these things are succinct. And so I really think that it's important that, you know, Brains, you go back and you listen to this conversation. Don't listen to it with a red hat or a blue hat. Listen to it with an open heart so that you can make an informed decision, because you can't make a good decision unless you have all the facts. And that's the truth. If the doctor came to you right now and said, you know what, I'm going to recommend this kind of treatment for this, this, and the other, you're going to ask him, what are my options? What are my choices? So expand that in everything you do, politically, socially, with your family, all of these things, expand your bandwidth. And a great place to start is with Julie. So tell my Brains how to get in contact with you.
I will. And I want to go back to something you said as I do that. So the easiest way to find me is the I Lead Strategies, just the words iLeadStrategies.com website. There's a little pop-up that allows you to send me a message and even get on my calendar. So just the I Lead Strategies website is where I want you to go. I want to go back to something you said though, April, because I think particularly for your younger viewers, we didn't talk about it, but it might be the most important thing you said. Voting is the least expensive in time or money way to make your voice heard. And I got into an interesting conversation with a young friend who's really the daughter of one of my closest friends in October. And she's like, it doesn't matter because even the Democrats aren't progressive enough and it doesn't matter. I'm like, here's the deal. You don't vote, you get what you get. And somebody is closer to where you are. So if we use the doctor analogy that you just used, April, and you go to the doctor and the doctor says, we can do surgery, we can do chemo, you know, between the two, we could do both. Nothing's 100%. I got news for you. You're going to pick one of them, right? You're going to decide. You're not going to walk out of the doctor's office with certainty of getting nothing. You're also not going to leave the doctor's office with a perfect answer. The same is true when you go to vote. The candidates you have are going to agree with you about some things and not everything. If you can't bring yourself to vote for a candidate who doesn't agree with you about everything, then I encourage you to figure out how you're going to run, because you aren't going to find another candidate that agrees with you about everything. But the easiest way to make your voice heard is to show up at a poll. Or have your vote show up at a poll, since we now are much better at doing this by mail and in other ways, is to have your vote counted. No, not voting is voting for the person you like least. So it's really important that you do that. And again, I'm Julie Jakopik. I lead strategies, and I work with leaders to build resilient organizations and resilient lives of their own so they can do that. And you can find me at iLeadStrategies.com.
You're the business. And thank you so much for, you know, putting this into bite-sized pieces so people can understand. Again, the views that are shared are our independent views. It doesn't mean that anybody is right or wrong. This just is from where the seat that we sit in. I sit in California. She sits in D.C. And we love you, Brains. I need you to go in and subscribe to every single thing, especially that YouTube channel. Go in and subscribe to the Blog Talk Radio Show. We have all kinds of great information. We are here on the edge to provide you cutting edge information in bite-sized pieces. And you know what? If you're not living on the edge, you're taking up way too much space. Talk to you again, Julie. Thank you so much, baby. You're
blessed. Thank you.